Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. As summer draws to a close, we're bringing you a few last summer reads to check out before we all go back to work and school full time. A novel that made it onto myriad best of summer reading lists, including the LA Times, CBS News, and Vogue, is from author Taylor Jenkins Reid. You're probably no stranger to Reid's work. Many of her books, like Daisy Jones and the Six and the Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, are New York Times bestsellers, and her new book, Malibu Rising, is no exception. The book explores the lives of the Riva siblings, Nina, Hud, Jay, and Kit, the children of an iconic crooner and ladies' man who left their mothers, plural, and left the kids to figure out their own lives. They bond over being survivors and their love of surfing. The Riva kids do fairly well for themselves, so much so that Nina's become a bit of a celebrity herself, a reluctant model whose annual end-of-summer bash is legendary. The book builds to the big event, which, as the book notes, by midnight, the party will be completely out of control. By morning, the Riva mansion will have gone up in flames. To kick us off, we've invited Reid to read an excerpt from the beginning of Malibu Rising so that she can set the tone. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, go for it.
All right. Malibu catches fire. It is simply what Malibu does from time to time. Tornadoes take the flatlands of the Midwest. Floods rise in the American South. Hurricanes rage against the Gulf of Mexico, and California burns. The land caught fire time and again when it was inhabited by the Chumash in 500 BCE. It caught fire in the 1800s when Spanish colonizers claimed the area. It caught fire on December 4th, 1903, when Frederick and May Ringe owned the stretch of land now called Malibu. The flames seized 30 miles of coastland and consumed their Victorian beach house. Malibu caught fire in 1917 and 1929, well after the first movie stars got there. It caught fire in 1956 and 1958, when the long borders and beach bunnies trickled to its shores. It caught fire in 1970 and 1978, after the hippies settled in its canyons. It caught fire in 1982, 1985, in 1993, 1996, in 2003, 2007, and 2018, and times in between, because it is Malibu's nature to burn.
Taylor, why did you want to make Malibu the setting for this book?
Oh, man, I love Malibu. I live here in Los Angeles, and I think that Malibu is one of the most fascinating places in the country. It's naturally beautiful. The mountains that back up right onto the Pacific Ocean are stunning. And I think that the fact that it's such a glamorous place with movie stars and mansions and so much beauty, and at the same time, such a rustic place where nature really rules over the way of life, makes it just a really, really fun, beautiful place to be.
And you also immerse us in the world of surfing. It's very important to the characters in this book. It's important for us to understand what it's meant to their lives. Are you a surfer?
I am not. I am faking it entirely. But I will say this. I think, you know, we all have those people that we thought were super cool when we were kids. And to me, when I was a kid, if you saw a surfer, that was like the very, very height of cool. Surfers were the coolest. And so when I was thinking about setting this story in Malibu, it felt like a really great opportunity to get to pretend to be a surfer for a minute. And so I interviewed some surfers. I read a lot of books about surfing, and I came to have so much respect for the people who get in the water when it's cold and it's early in the morning and they put on their wetsuit and they have to contend with Mother Nature in order to do what they love.
All right. For the setting, we have Malibu, we have the surfing culture, and then we have the 80s.
Yeah.
It's a primary decade of focus in the book. What was it about the 80s that helped you tell the story about these four siblings, their super famous dad, and this idea of what is a family and what do we owe each other?
Yeah, well, I think what's really fun about the 80s, and in particular the early 80s, is, look, we've seen the 80s depicted in a lot of different ways. But I think, you know, we think of the 80s as, you know, feathered hair and taffeta dresses, and it is that when it gets later. But I was sort of interested in the early 80s when our culture was still transitioning from the 70s into what the 80s would eventually become. And I liked the idea of setting this book during a period of time in which that feeling of excess, of decadence, of, you know, greed is good, that's just starting to trickle in. We're not at a full fever pitch yet. And so that's what was fun to me about setting this book in the 80s is that feeling of like the fun was sort of just beginning. And again, the 80s is a period of time. I think now we have such an awareness of the world around us and our place in it. In the 80s, there wasn't necessarily that much. We weren't as a culture paying attention to other people as much. We were allowed to or told that it was good to be entirely self-focused. I don't know that I agree with it, but it is a very fun period of time to write a story about.
My guest is Taylor Jenkins Reid. We're talking about her bestseller, Malibu Rising, one of the big books of the summer of 2021. So while the story is centered around this huge party, we'll get to the party in a minute and writing that crazy party, but there's discussions about fame and wealth and the way unconventional families function. So you have these four children after the abandonment by their famous father, and then their mother passes away. She has struggle with alcohol. The oldest child, Nina, essentially takes on the role of parent. What did you want to explore about traditional family dynamics? Because we learned a little bit about those early in the book, and then non-traditional family dynamics.
Yeah, thank you for picking up on all that, because I think in general I'm writing about non-traditional family dynamics a lot. Mm-hmm. I really love telling a story about what it means to be a family, whether that's chosen family or a family that looks a little bit different than we've been told family is supposed to look like. And the Rivas are very much that. You have Nina, who effectively has had to grow up and become a mother to her siblings. And then you have Jay, Hud, and Kit, who sometimes function like children and sometimes function like adults much older than they are. And what I was interested in is seeing the bond that exists when siblings have to very quickly restructure and fill those voids left by their parents. Mick and June are unable to, for various reasons, be in their lives. And so instead, you have this group of kids who band together, support each other, and find a way through it. And that felt really joyful to me, even though there's trauma around the family. The way that these siblings love each other and show up for each other and will do anything for each other feels like a really joyful space to write in.
So the famous father of the Riva siblings is Mick Riva, who's appeared in other of your books. And I'm sort of picturing, and this is no slap to any of these singers, but like sort of somewhere between like Tony Bennett meets Tom Jones meets kind of Frank Sinatra,
sure.
Right? Sort of a mix of all those.
Absolutely.
Now, I've read in interviews that you're not that fond of him sometimes, and it's understandable why. While he's charming and charismatic, he's got a very wild moral compass, or if he has one at all. So how do you approach writing a character that you don't necessarily like?
Can I tell you, this has been the biggest growing space for me as a writer over the course of this book, was realizing that you can't write a character that you don't like and just have a relationship with that character that is one of dislike. You can't do it. You won't present any sort of well-rounded character. And ultimately what I realized is that I have written Mick Riva in very small doses in other books, but because this was the book in which he really shows up and we get to know him, I had to learn how he becomes who he is. Mm-hmm. And once you understand why anyone is the way they are, you're going to have some empathy for them, even if you don't agree with their choices. And so what I really had to dig into with McRiva is how does someone become McRiva? How do they justify their choices when their choices hurt so many people? How do they justify their selfishness, and where does it come from? And once I learned that answer, I have to say, I have great affection for McRiva, even though I don't like anything that he does.
My guest is Taylor Jenkins Reid. We're talking about her book, Malibu Rising, one of the big books of the summer of 2021. So in this book, clearly you take on fame and celebrity and how it's changed over the course of decades as well. The Riva children have a famous father, but Nina becomes famous in her own right for sort of swimsuit modeling, reluctantly to help support her siblings. I'm thinking of the poster, the way you describe it, of that sort of like that Farrah Fawcett poster that became so popular in so many bedrooms of kids. What did you want to explore about fame and celebrity, because they're not necessarily the same thing?
No, that's very true. And you know, a lot of my work in my past couple of books has been about fame, but the women that I've written about previously in The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo and Daisy Jones and the Six are women that are very much seeking out fame and celebrity. They want people to know their name. They want attention. They want validation. They're looking for things externally. That is not the situation with Nina. And so Nina allowed me the opportunity to dive into some of the parts of fame and celebrity that are really damaging. And for Nina, the thing that is perhaps the most damaging is that question of, at what point do you stop belonging to yourself? If Nina's on a poster everywhere and she, you know, is in bedrooms across the country, at what point does she stop feeling like she owns what she looks like? And one of the things that Nina goes through is that there are people around her, mostly men, who feel like they know her or they can touch her or she belongs to them because of this sort of parasocial relationship that they have with an ad of hers, a poster of hers. And I wanted to dig into that feeling where people feel that they are owed something from the celebrities that they love. And so Nina was a really great opportunity to talk about the parts of fame that, at least for me, if I was put in that position, I would very much want to run from. Fame is not just, you know, getting invited to great parties and being beautiful all the time and everybody loves you. It's a really, really complicated thing to bring into your life.
So let's talk about this party. It's very interesting because part of the framing and the pacing, which is all around this one day leading up to this legendary party that Nina throws every year, which gets all kinds of out of hand and has these hilarious anecdotes about famous people just behaving so poorly. Like, it just gets out of control. Without giving too much away, what was important about this party for you as a writer, but also in terms of this story, and how did you think up some of those things those people do?
Yeah, well, I think what's important about the party is, and really the story in general, is that destruction always, you know, the end of destruction is always now an opportunity to rebuild something, right? Mm-hmm. So even though this party is really wild and crazy and all these people show up and they don't treat the house with respect and they swing from the chandeliers and they cause a lot of havoc, by the end of the book, there's an opportunity now to ask yourself the question, okay, well, this is gone, so what comes in its place? And so the party was a big part of that. But it's also just really fun. And I think, for me, I wanted to bring people to a wild, over-the-top 80s Hollywood party and make the reader feel not just like they were reading about it, but that they were there, that they're a fly on the wall, that they're, you know, hanging back in the corner, watching all of this chaos unfold. It's not a party that I ever want to go to because it's so crazy, but it is one that is fun to, I hope is fun, to be able to stand in the corner and watch it all go down. So I flooded this party with a bunch of different famous people. You've got an actress who has just left an actor at the altar a year ago and is not looking forward to seeing him again. You've got a TV star who is grieving his dead wife. You've got a screenwriter who still feels like the nerdy kid at school and just wants to find somebody to love. And creating them allows an opportunity for you to be at the party and see how each step leads to the next one, so that by the time we get to, you know, the early hours of the morning, it's too far gone.
There you go. You answered Emma Straub's question about why you kept it all in one space so that we could all be there. Of course, it's called Malibu Rising, as is in a phoenix rising from the ashes. You get the idea. My guest has been Taylor Jenkins Reid. Malibu Rising is a really fun read. If you want to read something over the holiday weekend, I suggest it highly. Taylor, thank you so much for being with us on All of It.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
And congratulations on all the success.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.